The unmistakable pipes of the late, great Marvin Gaye and one of his masterpieces, What's Going On? We're talking about the new book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers by Stanton Friedman, whom I've interacted with and interviewed many times over the last 27 years, and his co-author, Kathleen Martin, who this is my first interview with Kathy, but it's been a delight to speak to her and think she's a terrific guest. I'm sure you agree. In a moment, I'm going to ask them one more question each to talk about a UFO case, if there is one, that sort of scared them about the facts, the kind of interaction it had with humans, and if there is such a case. And then we open up the phone lines and we can talk about anything you want. Stan and I, as many of you probably know, have a disagreement about the Bob Lazar case. And we've talked about it many times, both in person and in interviews and in correspondence. And I don't mind talking about the Lazar case, but I can tell you that it's not going to take just a couple of minutes. It's going to take a lot of time. So I'd prefer to do that in a separate program if Stan is interested in doing that at some point, but it probably wouldn't be with me as the host. It would be me as a guest along with Stan. So those of you who want to ask about Lazar, I mean, you can go ahead and do it, but it's going to take a lot of time to cover, I think, all the stuff that we want to cover. So I'd really prefer that we do something else and get as many of your calls in as we can. But again, that's your call. We'll be right back with my guests, Kathleen Martin and Stan Friedman, and some of your calls and questions. As I mentioned, I'm going to ask my guests if there is a particular case that sort of gave them the willies. Start with Kathleen. I would imagine the Betty Hill case is pretty spooky by itself, but is that the case you'd like to mention, or is there something else?
There is something else that I would like to mention, and I don't know if you knew this, but I am MUFON's Director of Experiencer Research, and I have a team of individuals who work under me, and we investigate ET contact and alien abduction. For many, many years, in the investigations that I have done, I have felt that I've been dealing with extraterrestrials, probably coming here from another planet somewhere in our galaxy. But more recently, we have found case after case that involves UFOs. We have photographs, sometimes very good photographs of UFOs, sometimes photographs of beings that seem to be simply materializing. They're like shadow beings, and then you are beginning to see their features more and more. What I'm finding, and what my team is finding, is that there are negative beings that are coming through. And these negative beings might attach themselves to the humans. It's almost what we might think of in theology as demonic attachments. But they seem to be separate from the beings who travel in UFOs. They don't seem to be the same thing. My question, and the thing that bothers me the most, is are these beings coming from other planets and using interdimensional technology to come down, to take humans through walls, to walk through walls themselves, and is something occurring so that it's sort of like when we open a door to let in a guest, the bugs come in as well. Is this happening? Are there interdimensional beings? Are there astral beings on the outer edges of this interdimensional portal? And are they coming in to people's homes as well? And people become very ill. People develop scratches all over their bodies. This is not consistent with anything that I have seen in my many years of investigation of alien abductions. The marks are entirely different, but I'm seeing this occur more and more, and it really concerns me very much.
I'll tell you, Kathleen, it reminds me very much of Skinwalker Ranch, the property in Utah that was investigated by Bob Bigelow's team from NIDS over a period of several years. the kinds of activity, it starts with UFOs and then expands into other things, and it's harsh and negative and manipulative, not at all friendly space brethren here to help humanity, but just really weird kind of stuff. It's like a clearinghouse for all kinds of strange activity that includes UFOs, but is not necessarily about UFOs, and that's what it made me think of. We might have to exchange notes, because there's a similarity to what you're describing about how things attach themselves to people. It's not only the people who directly interact with it, but it seems to spread to others in their realm, in their families, people they come into contact with, almost like a virus. And
even to the investigators. I'm aware of a case where this occurred on the panhandle in Florida, and an investigator went to that area to investigate what was going on, and that investigator developed an attachment to these creatures that they thought were reptilian, and took that attachment unwillingly, and still has that attachment. So it can be a little bit dangerous for the investigators who are going in.
Yeah, it's there have been cases where it follows people home, I mean, to other states.
Yeah,
we're going to have to talk about that. I appreciate it. By the way, there's some news coming about Skinwalker Ranch, what people call the Skinwalker Ranch. I'm not going to give you all the details, but for those of you who follow that story, the property's been sold, and you're going to hear more about it real soon. Stan, is there a UFO case or incident or a trend or something like that that you've come across in your many, many years of investigation that really gives you the willies?
Well, I guess I'd say there are a couple of them really quickly. The Cuban MiG case, where saucers heading toward Cuba, they put up a couple of fighters, and what should we do? Shoot it down, because they don't respond. The UFO doesn't respond. So the first pilot says his missile is armed, got a radar lock on, and then the second pilot screams over the airwaves that the first plane just disintegrated. And they got asked by this is an NSA listening post, and they got asked to send the original tape, which had never happened before. And that's scary that they seem to be able to do what they please. And along the same lines, well, a little different, Flatwoods, West Virginia. I've been there with Frank Fascino, who's written an excellent book about the Flatwoods monster. And just the concept of something that's more than 8 feet tall traipsing around in the woods, scaring the heck out of people. How many of these are there? And, you know, are they a threat to humanity? They took off, but what are they here for? What's their business here? That's kind of scary when you really have no idea what's going on. So I do get worried about these things from time to time. On the other hand, I don't think there's anything that aliens have done to us, and I'm sure they have done plenty, that exceeds what we have done to ourselves.
Yeah,
our history is not a very enlightened one.
Yeah, can I get an amen on that? All right, let's take some calls. First-time caller, Spencer in Atlanta. Good morning, Spencer.
George, is serendipity doing? And George Norrie have the same first name.
I guess so. What's on your mind?
The young lady is your guest, and the gentleman, Stan, they talking about opening up a can of worms. That can of worms already been opened up.
What do you mean?
I mean that if anybody don't believe there's somebody else in this universe other than us, I don't know what to say about it.
Well, we're with you on that. The problem is, as they've been, Stanton and Kathleen have been talking about tonight, it's trying to get their colleagues, scientists, and journalists to take it seriously. That's the problem. Did you have a question for him, Spencer?
Well, yes, I have a question. Why wouldn't anybody believe that we are the only one in the universe?
Or I guess, why would somebody believe that we are the only one? Stan, you've dealt with that question many
times. Why would anyone believe that we are the only one in the universe?
Yeah, I hear you. Stan, you've tackled that one before.
Well, just because they've been told that all the intelligent life, as I said earlier, in the universe is right here on planet Earth, forgetting the larger picture. There's an ego involvement, a religious involvement, but there are people who believe that. I've met them on airplanes who are sure that there's nobody out there. And you can only go so far in trying to put evidence on the table. I can't provide an alien for anybody. I don't have a piece of a saucer that I say was made of unknowium or unobtainium. And I don't try to convince these people. I deal with facts and data, and I find that by checking out my lectures that fewer than 2% of the people have read any of the large-scale scientific studies I discuss. So I'm not going to try to climb that mountain of people who say there can't be and therefore there isn't. I can't answer that question, in other words.
Spencer, thank you. Appreciate it. Going east of the Rockies to Clark in New Jersey. Good morning, Clark.
Hi, good morning. I saw an object what appeared to be a spacecraft. I know it sounds crazy. We never really told anybody this till years later. This is a very long time ago, back in the early 60s, and it was very close. It was right on top of us. There were three of us. I was a young kid, maybe 14 years old, 13, 14 or 15, I can't even remember. We're walking through a clearing in the park, and all of a sudden, there were three of us going from one of the oldest guy was going for a job, and we're right in the middle of the clearing, and all of a sudden, this thing was right on top of us. Right on top of us. It was about as tall as the tallest tree in the park, or maybe 100 feet above us, and it just stood there. It was right on top, right above us, and it's as if it were laying on the ground. It didn't move, it didn't budge. It was and I was looking at this thing, and it was completely spherical. It looked like some kind of metal that light was coming through it, and it wasn't flashing or anything. It was just a solid light that was emanating from the material. It was like an orange red, and no noise, nothing, and it just stood there right on top of us. Didn't budge an inch.
And, did you report it to somebody?
No, I didn't report it. My friends didn't report it. Years later, I was thinking of reporting it. I think I wrote a letter to one of the UFO places.
Organizations, yeah.
Maybe it was MUFON, but we never even told anybody. It was like amazing. It was who was going to believe us, first of all, and who are you going to report it to, the authorities? I thought in my head. I remember thinking, what are they going to do? They couldn't do anything. And then, but years later, I thought of it, and I wrote a letter, and that was it. And we, you know, never told anyone publicly other than that after.
Well, let's get some reaction from our guests here. Kathleen, you hear these kind of stories all the time. People who, you know, who knows how many are out there who've never told anybody about it?
A large percentage of my audiences, I believe, are holding information. They have an interest in the topic because they've had their personal experiences. And perhaps they told somebody, and that person laughed at them or asked them what they were drinking or smoking, and then they shut up and they didn't tell anyone else until they came to me and felt that they could trust me because I have a serious interest in this field. But it happens over and over again. I also receive cases from men who, when they were boys, were with a group of other boys who might have been out playing on the farm or in a park or in the woods. A craft came down close to them, and they were taken aboard the craft. And at least one of them has been taken periodically throughout their lifetime. So it's quite common for this to occur.
We'll try a wild card line. Jeff in Culver City. Jeff, I don't know how you always get through, but you're always welcome here. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks so much, George. Appreciate it. Hey, George, Mr. Friedman, and Mrs. Martin. Yes, this UFO activity is very real, but there's two components that, you know, prevents regular, everyday, run-of-the-mill people from actually seeing these crafts, or even the entities which may, you know, have been aboard, you know, these operating crafts or whatever. And I say may be aboard because given this ability to operate, you know, cars and other mechanical, you know, devices without human navigation, you know, similar to the Google driverless car experiments or remote control planes and drones, it seems to me that, you know, of course, all this stuff, you know, the American people and the populace of the world have been led, you know, or lied to for years, you know, because of this massive selfish cover-up or whatever has been going on for decades. But my question is this, Mr. Friedman and Mrs. Martin, since these crafts, which are very gigantic in size, some smaller, you know, and connected with whatever, you know, larger ones that exist, do you believe that the reason for this secrecy on the existence of all of this was to disguise or cover up the designs, functions, and structures of these crafts, you know, their dimensions and all that? And, you know, do you believe that all of this is unbelievable, the secrecy meant to selfishly hoard this information for only powerful or dominant governments like the U.S. or Russia? And I'll take your answer off there.
Well, I'll take a quick shot at that. I think one reason for the cover-up is because of the technological implications that we may have learned something by studying the data that we've obtained about the craft. I think that's an important part of it, but I also think the fear of the impact on giving up power. Kathy mentioned about earthlings, I mean, nationalistic stuff. Nobody in power wants to give up power. And no country is going to say, well, we're going to have a world government. That doesn't seem to be in the cards for this planet for some time anyway. So in some of my other books, I've gone into the answers to the why questions. But there are a lot of different answers because I don't have any alien to interrogate. And there may be many different, how many reasons were there for people to come to the New World after Columbus? To steal the gold, to convert the heathen, to bring back new vegetables, you know, there's a plethora of motivations for aliens, apparently, as well as for earthlings. So I think there are a lot of different things going on, but certainly nobody wants to give up power, and you don't want to induce panic in the public. If the government were to say, well, like, we got all these craft coming here, and we can't do a darn thing about it, people are going to lose faith in their government, because if they can't do anything about these things, what about a Russian attack, a Chinese attack, who knows what? So there are serious concerns on the part of people in power. Also, you have to admit you've been lying for 70 years, and I don't know many governments that want to do that.
Yeah, some people might go to jail. I know when I went to Russia and brought back formerly classified documents, spoke to the Ministry of Defense folks over there who were in charge of their massive 10-year UFO study, they made it pretty clear that they were studying it for very practical reasons. They wanted to see if they could learn something about stealth technology because they knew that UFOs could do things that their aircraft could not do. So it was a very practical thing. They wanted to get an advantage over us, and that's not the kind of thing that if they were able to crack the technology that they'd be willing to share with the world. You know, Kathleen, I know you probably want to jump into that, but we're going to a break here now. If you want to respond to Jeff's comments and questions, we can do it on the other side, and we'll get to as many of your calls and comments as we can on our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Stick around. The song is Right Man for the Job by Texas troubadour and full-time colorful character Charlie Robison. It makes me smile just hearing him. If he weren't a singer-songwriter, I think he could be a humorist. He's got some really funny and clever stuff. We're talking with Stan Friedman and Kathleen Martin about their new book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. The phones are pretty full. We'll get to as many of your calls and comments as we can in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Kathy Martin, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to the question from Jeff, if you wanted to, or if not, we can move on to something else.
I would have responded in the same manner that you and Stanton did. There's only one thing that I want to address, and he mentioned the possibility that some of these vehicles might be remote controlled. And it brought back memories of reports that came to us during the 1960s of small, apparently remote-controlled vehicles that would hover outside the windows of people's homes and startle them. And maybe it was an intelligence gathering operation by extraterrestrials and larger craft. We don't know for sure, but there is the possibility that some of these are remote controlled. And we also have to raise the question of whether or not these are sentient, living and breathing beings on the craft, or if they are intelligent robots. And it appears from all of the reports, I've talked to well over 1,000 experiencers that I have received, that it appears to be a combination of both. The small servants, the helpers, the police force on board the craft appears to be these smaller robotic-type beings, but there appears also to be sentient beings on the craft who are responsible for the higher-level activities.
We'll go west of the Rockies. Howard in Vancouver. Good morning, Howard. You're on with Stan and Kathy.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to share my suspicions about the UFO secrecy. I think that perhaps there is an economic angle to all of this. Now, as you recall, Ronald Reagan's speech before the United Nations General Assembly, he suggested that if the world were confronted with an extraterrestrial threat, that nations would begin to cooperate and hostilities would cease. Now, if he was right, this would be the worst possible thing for the international arms dealers and bankers. It's in their best interest to keep trouble stirred up. Now, they have the means to pressure elected officials, and that would be passed right down the chain of command to keep all of this quiet. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Stan?
Well, it could have something, you know, that's an interesting hypothesis, let's put it that way. I won't rule it out that some of this may be the result of people wanting the world to think of these things in a different way from what they really are. I don't know. I'm a physicist, not a psychiatrist.
I can appreciate that.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Thought-provoking stuff. On our first-time caller list is Gary, who is a trucker in Wisconsin. Gary, are you on the road right now?
Yes, sir.
What's on your mind?
I'd like to share a story with you back from 1982, back when I was a kid and actually had hair.
Okay.
Me and a bunch of my friends, we dared our friend, Wendell, who wanted to ride our motorcycle with us. He was like 14, 15 years old. And we weren't going to let him ride, but we told him the only way we would let him ride is if he went to his father's house and stole a bottle of his dad's whiskey so we could all sit and drink and have fun while we're running our motorbikes all over the place. Well, we would kind of want to hide from the parents because all the parents, they knew where our little clubhouse was and they knew where we ran. So we ran down the railroad tracks, and as we're there at the railroad tracks drinking the bottle, we noticed this little orange ball of light up in the sky just zipping all over the place. And we're watching it. We're still drinking. And it stops, and it just starts getting closer to us. Well, our friend Jeff took the bottle after it was gone and chucked the bottle toward it. And just in a matter of seconds, it went from being way out there to just being about 350 yards away from us, and it just looked like a big old ball of sun. And after Jeff had chucked the bottle out of it, it wasn't orange anymore. It was like illuminating silver color. And it just sit there just beaming us. I mean, we're all scared. You know what word I want to use. I mean,
yeah.
I don't want to say that kind of word on the air, especially on this show for this family program. But we were scared out of our wits, I'll put it like that. And it backed up, and then it just shot off into the sky. Well, we're all waiting. We're maybe a three-quarter mile away from the neighborhood. We all jump on our bikes and we're heading back in the neighborhood, and just out of nowhere, it comes buzzing right over the top of us, another good 200, 300 feet above our head. and just zipped right past us. It had the trees blowing. There was no sound to it, none whatsoever. And it just buzzed us, and we get back in the neighborhood. There's people standing on their front porches. I mean, there was probably 200 people that had actually accounted for seeing this object, whatever they call it. And 3 days later, they didn't have nothing in the paper the first day or the second day, but 3 days later, they called it a malfunctioned weather balloon. That was not a malfunctioned weather balloon. No possible way.
Well, let me ask Kathleen. You have cases, I'm sure, in the MUFON files or maybe in your own files of something similar to what Gary's describing, where people interact with these craft, where they sometimes people shoot at them. You know, they'll take a pot shot at them or flash a flashlight and get a reaction, right?
Yes, absolutely. We have many cases, particularly of people flashing a flashlight at the object and all of a sudden just zips down and it's right on top of the person. And he mentioned first the orange orb, and it reminded me of Betty's and Barney's description of observing an orange orb that appeared to be sitting on the ground, and it was moving, but it started to move, but they were not moving. And when they were taken, that orange orb suddenly became, it appeared to have cooled off, and it became a silvery disk. So that's pretty consistent with UFO sightings.
Let's try east of the Rockies, Rick in Louisiana. Hi, Rick.
How are you doing this morning?
Oh, we're doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to relate a story. Maybe you can help me confirm some of the stuff. I rode on a plane about 10 years ago, and the lady next to me, when I started a conversation, when she started talking, her husband went one of these, you know, oh, no, not again. but she was telling me that her one of her in-laws was one of the Project Blue Book people. And maybe to like to confirm who he was, it was somebody who was a professor from South America. He taught up in New York, I think it was physics, but he was on Project Blue Book. And some of the, you know, a couple of interesting things on it was that they said that on some of their, when they were ready to do interviews with some of the people that they really, really, really thought had some type of significant sighting, that oftentimes the people would be dead by the time they got there to do the interview.
Ooh.
And I don't know if you've ever heard any of that. And one of the things she related to that he told her that they knew for sure that there was at least four different alien races. One of them, you know, like the Close Encounters one where you got the little, you know, the little gray and then the spindly tall ones. And then also the Nordic type. And then I don't remember what the fourth one was. It was either the insectoid or the lizard type. But I don't know. Have you ever heard anything like that? And does that person sound familiar?
Stan, have you ever heard of the guy he's describing? No?
It doesn't ring a bell with me as to who that might have been.
You know, the idea of four alien races, I remember the U.S. Air Force, that chapter in the physics textbook that was for the Air Force Academy mentioned four races, I think.
Well, who knows how many there are. No reason to say there's only one.
Agreed. We're going to try. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for calling in. On the international line, we go to Bob in Victoria, Canada. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
All right. What's on your mind?
Great. I have a question for either Stanton or seeing as where he lives now or Kathleen herself. Have you ever looked into the Shag Harbor incident?
Yes. I've been at two conferences down in Shag Harbor and talked to the people. There's a whole book by two different people. You know, send me an email and I'll give you further information about that. But yes,
yeah. What was your concern?
Harbor's a good case.
Yeah, it was, because there was a lot involved. There was a two-part incident involving three law enforcement agencies and a military in the military. But yeah, I'll do that. That would be good. Thank you.
Bob, do you have personal experience in this, or you've mostly read about it?
I have, I'm going to say, secondhand experience. I myself was a member of the armed forces for a number of years, and there was, let's just say, there was talk about it when I first joined.
Oh, I'll bet Stan would like to hear more from you then. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
I'm going to go to wildcard line, JP in Pueblo, Colorado. Good morning, JP. You're on with Stan and Kathleen.
Hello. You're the best, George. I'm trying to keep it quick, and I hope I don't sound like an idiot. It's a physics-related question, so I guess Stan would probably be the guy that's most interested. And, you know, I'm just a normal person. I'm not a brainiac, but I've read some stuff on quantum physics and such, and I, you know, read about electron spin and how it really just doesn't go in a circle, but it seems to kind of go somewhere else before its spin is complete, like a Mobius strip. I've seen the super high-speed images of a nuclear detonation in its earliest stages, and the shape that appears is sort of like a Mobius strip, but it's more spherical, but it's like a sphere that's turning in on itself. And I've wondered if possibly the reason for alien interest in our nukes is that when we detonate a nuke, it detonates in a parallel universe, a nearby universe or something, that the energy goes elsewhere. Also maybe why nuclear weapons are still relatively inefficient explosions. And if Stan would like to address that, if it's possible that...
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's hear what Stan has said.
I mean, an important part of nuclear weapons and where they fit into this picture is that any advanced civilization knows that once you have exploded nuclear weapons, you can use nuclear energy, especially fusion energy, to go to the stars. That makes you a threat to the neighborhood, so to speak. I worked on I worked on fission nuclear rockets back in, the late 60s. And, I also was involved in a study of fusion for deep space propulsion. And back in 1962, and we concluded, if you want to go, all it takes is dough. And fusion is the most important source of energy throughout the universe. So suddenly the primitives on planet Earth became ready to join the big shots, if you will, out there. I'm not saying fusion is the ultimate, but three numbers. Big Bomb in 1944 was a 10-ton blockbuster, released the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. The first atomic bomb the next year released the energy of, like, better than 15,000 tons of dynamite. And the first fusion device in 1952, 10 million tons of dynamite, one lousy bomb. And the Russians set one off that was 57 million tons of dynamite energy release. So the nuclear stuff fits into the picture as an indication that, frankly, I think they want to quarantine us. Who would want us out there?
I'll try to get at least one more call in. Michael in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right.
I had an incident with Philip Klass. Going back to like 1980, 81. Klass used to boast that he was the editor of Aviation Week and Space Technology, one of the top magazines at the time. And while he's announcing UFOs, he's looking at my credentials and so forth. So I went to the library and looked up old issues of Aviation Week during the Vietnam War period, 8-year period. And he promoted a lot of junk, a lot of weapon systems, billions of dollars. He wrote articles praising it, wasting taxpayers' money and so forth. I wrote a letter to Fate Magazine about it, and he was furious. He was very angry. He wrote back. He said, he had nothing to do with these articles. He was associate editor or something like that.
He was
with that.
Senior avionics editor is
later,
what he was.
And he accused me of anti-Semitism. I'm Jewish myself. He says, I'm spreading anti-Semitism by accusing him of wasting money during the Vietnam War and so forth with that stuff. And then he tried to get back at me. He said, look, send me copies of all the articles. So I spent hours copying all the articles. Said it to him and he never replied. Like, it's just to make me aggravate me. But I did hurt him. I did hurt him with that Vietnam War business. And he was involved with that, all those crazy weapon systems and waste of money that went on at that time.
Okay, he was only senior avionics editor of Aviation Week and Space Technology. He was not the editor.
So in dozens of articles under his name concerning the Vietnam War weapon systems.
Yeah, well, he wrote articles about all kinds of stuff.
And what class asked you to do is pretty typical of his behavior. He would give many people assignments to accomplish something for him. It would take the heat off from him and have other people working for him.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate the call. We've got about 3 minutes left. I wanted to ask each of you to comment on something that the book is great. It's comprehensive. One thing that that I'd like to get your take on, though, that is not mentioned in Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers are about hoaxes. As you mentioned, Stan, in the early military studies, they said, look, it's only, even though they were debunking the topic, they said only 2% of the cases we're looking at are hoaxes. What is your take, and Kathy, yours as well, on the development of CGI technology combined with the internet, the idea that people can make money putting out a fake UFO video? Now it's really muddied the waters even further and discredits the topic, I think.
Well, I agree with you, George. How's that?
I mean, it's hard to separate. It's hard to separate.
Much more difficult now than it would have been 20 years ago, yes.
And I think that we have to remember that the reports that we received so long ago, particularly during Project Blue Book times, were of people who were making reports to the Air Force, an authority figure, and that their reports would be investigated. Today, any teenager can put something onto the internet, and so the waters are very muddied today. MUFON is still receiving around 2% of its cases are hoaxes. So when it comes to making a formal report, that's another thing. But the internet is loaded with that sort of thing. And sometimes I wonder if some of those hoaxes are being perpetrated by informants whose job it is to hoax this type of information in order to dissuade the general public from believing any of it.
I wouldn't be surprised. Kathleen, it's been great to talk to you. It's the first time I've had a chance to interview you, and I'm just really impressed. I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much.
I have too.
And Stan, you and I, we go way back. I mean, I was just adding up the years. It's 27 years now, and yes. We've had some very spirited discussions, and I know we have more in our future, and it's always great to have you. I love the book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. I hope people will check it out because it's very comprehensive. Thank you both.
Thanks, George. I've enjoyed it.
All right, and I thank my colleagues there. Nathan Staten, who's back with me on Sunday nights. Great to have him back on the Sunday night team. Our caller screener, Donna Walker. Our webmaster, Lex Lonehood. Dan Galante, and our producer, Chris Boros. Good night, everyone. I'll be back next Sunday night. See you then.